Hello, and welcome to the AgTech So What podcast. Emerging technologies are rapidly changing the global agricultural industry, and we believe that this revolution is only getting started. But there's still too much hype out there and too big of a disconnect between ag and ag tech. So on this show, we try to bridge that gap. In each episode, we bring you the story of a different innovator in agriculture and try to find the place where ag and tech meet. I'm your host, Sarah Nolette. Today's guest is Mick Fells. Mick is someone I've wanted to speak to ever since I read an article he wrote called How I Make Money Out of iPaddock. It's Not What You Think. Mick has built and commercialized a range of products with iPaddock, from apps to machinery. And I wanted to chat with him about how he thinks about making money from technology and what building products has taught him about startups and about farming. Mick and I also talk about hard-earned lessons and tips for working with technology, whether ideas or execution matter more, and which is harder, farming or building ag tech products. Mick and his wife Marnie farm in Esperance on the south coast of Western Australia. We start with Mick telling us about the farm.
We're farming just over 6,000 hectares here. We started farming in 93. My wife and I, we got married in 93 and bought our first farm in 93. For the princely sum of $40 an acre while our friends were travelling the world and whatever else they were doing. We traded our two cars in to get some capital and bought a farm. So that's sort of how we started out, and we sort of built it up from there. We both had engineering degrees before we went farming, which has been a really good career path for us. And we built the farm up and sold the original property in 2001 and bought into a better area with better rainfall and soils in 2002. And we've grown the business since then. So we own about 4,000 hectares and we lease another couple of thousand, some off my dad and some off the neighbour. So I'm growing wheat, barley and canola and a little bit of legumes. We're playing around with legumes.
Take me back to when you and your wife decided to sell your cars and buy a farm. Was that, what was the thinking there? Did everyone think you were crazy?
They did. No, you hit the nail on the head. So we both went to uni. I was one of the younger kids in a family of five and I didn't really expect to be a farmer. Always enjoyed growing up on the farm, but I went and did an engineering degree and thoroughly loved it. Actually did my honours thesis on aerodynamics of wind turbines, so that I found that fascinating. But the little bit of work I did in the field, I just did not like the office environment at all, just didn't agree with me. So when I finished uni, I took the opportunity to come home to the farm for 6 months. Well, that was the plan, just to help Dad out. And just clear my head a bit. I didn't even apply for an engineering job. And my wife, Marnie, she did chemical engineering at Curtin University. I studied at UWA. And we met at college, actually. We're both from the country. She's from up north in WA. And we met at college, had a great time in Perth for 4 years. And she worked for a couple of years as a chem engineer while I was at the farm. And, my dad talked me into buying a farm that was out on the fringe. It was sort of not in very good shape, but it was cheap and it was affordable. So the only capital that we had at the time was our cars. So we downsized and sold one of the cars. This is the year we got married. That was 93. So we sold one of the cars and scratched up as much as we could. We bootstrapped it, I suppose, is the modern language for what we did. And persuaded the bank to exceed their... Yeah, exactly. Persuaded the bank to exceed their normal parameters to lend us the money. And, we managed to buy our first farm and sort of did it pretty tough for a few years.
Was it scary to do that? Like, were you nervous about it?
Well, my long-term memory has never been good and I sort of forget things. So I think I'm busy looking ahead. I forget to sort of retain things. But the only emotions that I recall from back then is excitement, really. Obviously, there was stress and everything else with it, but really it was the excitement of the opportunity. And probably one of the saving things for me was I didn't know about farming. I was raised on a farm, but it was a livestock farm predominantly, and we were getting into cropping and just a huge learning curve, which I've always enjoyed learning. It was just a big, exciting opportunity. I think if we had have known what we were going into, we probably should have been frightened, but I think we were just excited. It was really exciting times. We actually went backwards for the first 3 years, which is seems to be what we've done every time we bought a farm. We've had a bad run the first few years or just invested heavily in trying to build the property up or something. So, but even then, we didn't really worry too much about that. I suppose we had nothing to lose, you know, like we came in with nothing. So the worst that would happen is we'd leave with nothing.
Mick says that in the early days, they probably did make a bunch of mistakes, but he's really positive about these experiences as they've helped him to learn and to get better.
I've never been the kind to beat myself up for my mistakes because I see them as a learning opportunity. It's the same as, you know, with the ag tech stuff I've got into more recent times. You know, it's normal to make mistakes. Actually, I sort of push the boundaries a bit and I don't want to make mistakes, but I don't mind making mistakes because they're such great learning experiences and then you can use that learning to do better in the future. So, we've made lots of mistakes along the way, but it's been those mistakes that have sort of made us into good, profitable farmers now, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things we hear a lot on the podcast and other farmers I talk to. The biggest kind of advice around, especially some of this ag tech stuff, but I guess farming more generally, is you're going to lose some skin along the way.
Exactly. And you know, a mistake is only a failure if you don't learn from it. You know, that's sort of one of my sort of senses of how we go about these things. So long as you learn from it, you can actually make a mistake into something valuable. If you're not standing on the edge, you take up too much space. Well, that's what he thinks is my attitude. So it's a little bit like that. You know, we do push the parameters a fair bit, and sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. But in the balance, you're constantly learning new things and you retain the things that were good and you drop off the things that didn't work out. And over the long term, and farming is a long game, you know, it pays off.
An example of Mick pushing the boundaries happened early on when he decided to move from mixed farming to just cropping and to adopt new systems and technologies like controlled traffic to make this change work.
Well, our controlled traffic journey, I suppose, had been evolving for some time. I think it was about 2002 when I bought my first John Deere autosteer controller, which is 10 years before we sold the cattle. So we never went down the guidance path. I never had a guidance screen or anything. I just went straight into an auto steer controller and put it in the seeder, auto steered the seeder, and then left wheel tracks unseated on the seeder, and everything else followed those visually. So that was sort of how we started down the path of controlled traffic. I liked the idea of it. And I suppose it grew from there. So, you know, that's nearly 20 years ago now. And even now, we're still not pure controlled traffic. You know, some of our machines are 2.7 metre wheel tracks and some are 3.2. But I think the important thing is that we've still got, you know, 80% plus of the paddock almost never gets driven on, and we do see the benefits. So I suppose it was a pretty slow burn for us. And by 2012, you know, we weren't making money out of the cattle. The prices were disastrous. They were about 25% of what they are nowadays. And we weren't making a lot of money out of the cattle. They were distracting us from our cropping business, which has always been our main enterprise. And going to Moree, I was looking at some machinery actually and going to Moree and seeing how those guys around there are doing it. You know, I was really motivated when I came home. We had a conversation about it together and decided let's take the plunge and do this thing properly. So that's what we did. And it's been great. Like, I'm so pleased. I know cattle have improved a lot since then, but as you get older, you get wiser. And I'm starting to work out, I think most people can really only specialise in one thing. It's hard to be a specialist in more than one thing, and trying to be a specialist in livestock as well as in cropping. Well, for me, I always found that one or the other was being compromised. So I do feel like, and in fact, our metrics will show, you know, business performance had definitely improved since we got rid of the cattle and we can just focus solely on, you know, high performance cropping.
For Mick, pushing the boundaries hasn't just been about farming systems. It's also about technology and engineering. Things he's had a passion for since he was little.
Yeah, well, I am a sort of a natural innovator. I loved mechanical engineering. And, as a kid, I was pulling apart bloody transistor radios and motorbike engines and whatever, you know, like I just loved knowing how things work. So it worked out well for us when we started farming, because like I mentioned, we didn't really have any money to bless ourselves with. So we had a lot of old, worn-out equipment, but I was able to fix it, get it working, and get it working well, and modify it to sort of do the job we needed it to do, and even built some of my machinery in those days, out of old metal and whatever. So that certainly helped us to get started, but as the business grew and we started making some profits and being able to buy equipment, I sort of stopped doing all that because it just made more sense to buy what we needed that did the job and get on with actually farming rather than fabricating things. But we sort of turned a bit of a corner 10 or 15 years ago, where we started to feel like the things that I knew we needed in our business from my own experience weren't really available. You know, like I'm really probably trying to customise things a bit. And I tended to find it became a bit of a standing joke on the farm with the staff, actually, that before a new machine could go into the paddock, it would spend a week at the workshop, and that was sort of how it started happening. So I was modifying things a lot because while you can buy something that sort of, I mean, most of this machinery you buy, particularly stuff from North America, which is where a lot of it comes from, it's a one-size-fits-all solution. It's the same machine that you get in Canada, the USA, right through Europe, South America, Africa, everywhere. You know, they're all using identical equipment, but it's a bit fanciful to think that one machine is going to suit all of those environments. So I would always be just fine-tuning it, just trying to get that extra bit of performance out of it or make it sort of do more for me.
Mick has done a lot of this customization work, tweaking existing products to make them work for his farm. But in a few cases, Mick has gotten to the point where customization just wasn't enough. It was actually easier and ultimately better to start over and build something new.
I was using a John Deere disc seeder and having all sorts of problems with it, but I really liked what the discs were doing to our soil, but it just wasn't performing the way I needed it to in our soils and with our chemistry that we were using. So I heavily modified it and it was working really well, but I had all sorts of reliability problems and I actually decided to start building my own units from the ground up, and that's sort of evolved over 5 or 6 years now into the AlphaDisc, which is an all-new unit, which is basically custom-made. It's mass-produced, but it's custom-made for the sorts of things that we're trying to do here in Australia in terms of, for instance, using Treflan, which is a problem with normal disc seeders, and not wetting sands, which are a bit of a problem for us. It's sort of dealing with that, moisture seeking. All the things that disc seeders don't normally do are the things that I've sort of built into my AlphaDisc, and we've seen our, you know, water use efficiencies and just our overall productivity and profitability just been on a steady rising plane probably pretty much since we started doing that. So I can see that we're definitely on the right track.
Over time, as technology has improved, Mick's innovations have gone beyond equipment and machinery to apps and more of what today we call ag tech.
When the iPads came out in 2011, I got a few iPads with some chemical X. It was a bit of a, you know, like one of those freebie things that you actually pay for. But anyway, I got a few iPads. I was keen to try them out. And as soon as I got them, I could just see, you know, that sort of mobile portable device with data sharing was just going to be priceless in our business. And I had a look at all the different apps that were around, and I could just see that they were built by IT people, your business people, entrepreneurs. You know, they weren't really tailoring the sorts of things that the practical things that I knew we could do with those devices. So took the plunge. We were ready for something a bit new in the business, and we set up iPaddock to develop a couple of apps. And in 2013, we released two apps, which was iPaddock Spray and iPaddock Yield. And iPaddock Spray was really taking control of the spraying operation because we were going through a rapid growth phase in the business at that stage, and I was relying on staff to do a lot more of the key operations like spraying, and I was having trouble managing our inventory of chemicals and managing the quality control on the spraying and just keeping the communication open between myself and the spray driver. And we were making mistakes, you know, like you'd have a paddock. Well, I've had an instance where a paddock got sprayed twice, and I've had other instances where parts of a paddock didn't get sprayed and you thought they had been just communication breakdown. So one of those failures can cost you $10,000, $20,000. So took the plunge and decided to build these apps based on what we knew we needed. And I thought, well, if we're going to do this, then we'd be silly not to commercialise it, because I'm pretty sure if we need it, then other people do too.
It was at this time, around 2013, that Mick set up iPaddock, a company that would help him bring these apps to market. So what was driving Mick to not only build technology, but also to commercialize it?
Right from the get-go, the primary reason for doing it, I suppose, was to develop what we needed. You know, we were growing our business, and I could just see the value to our business of having good tools like that. So when Marnie and I discussed it, one of the things that we considered was, even if we don't make money out of it, it's worth doing it just, I mean, this is how crazy it is. An app that you can buy for $180 in the app store, you know, as a buyer of apps, you know, it's cost us thousands of times that to produce it, and even then it was still worth doing. So the value proposition for people just buying the app is pretty good. But even in our case, even if we didn't sell a single copy, it was really a case of needing it for our business. Mm. So the way we priced our apps, it's sort of a protest, really. Like I get grumpy at all these, you know, everybody wants you to sign up to an account and pay subscriptions before you've even seen what the product is. And then you're locked in and it's really hard to get out again. So it probably doesn't make a lot of sense from a business point of view, but we just had a low entry price and no subscriptions. So when you work it out, we never really set out to make any great fortunes out of my apps. And as much as anything, I sort of have a passion for the industry and I'm a bit of a sharer. Anybody who follows me on Twitter will know that. I like to share, and I like to share in a two-way stream, you know, people helping me and me helping people where I can. And I suppose, really, the apps have always been a bit of an adjunct to our business, and I sort of don't mind having them there and supporting them because I know how important they are to the people who use them. And I guess in some ways it's a bit of a contribution to the industry that I love, is helping drive the productivity of the industry.
Another reason Mick felt it was important to create iPaddock was because he saw limitations in the current system of research and development. Whether from big or small companies or research organizations or industry bodies, he's seen a lot of money and time being wasted on products that weren't actually helping farmers.
That sort of takes me back to my motivation for doing this stuff. You know, a lot of my friends look at me and think, why the hell do you do this, Felsie? You know, like, just go and buy what you need and just put up with it. Don't constantly have the need to change things. But I do get frustrated because I can tell people till I'm blue in the face what I need, and they just keep churning out the same stuff. And same with our R&D system. It's become very bureaucratic. I mean, there's hundreds of millions of dollars every year invested, a lot of that directly from people like me on our farms. But by the time the good ideas make it through the food chain, it's really difficult to actually get progress in terms of innovative solutions. Mm. So the established process, and it makes commercial sense, but the conventional process, I guess, is to commercialise stuff that you know there's a market for. And what that actually means is anything innovative and disruptive, you have to actually build that market, and you're not going to get a great commercial return on it anytime soon unless you plan to stick with it for 10 or 15 years. So getting the R&D bodies and commercial, you know, mainstream brands to develop stuff like that, it ain't going to happen in my lifetime. So if you feel strongly enough about it, you've really got to get in there and do it yourself, pick up the shovel, do the work. And, I mean, we're very fortunate. We've got a good farm business which pretty much bankrolls iPaddock for us. So iPaddock doesn't have to sort of churn out a profit every year, or certainly doesn't have to churn out a big profit. Mind you, money keeps a blowtorch on me to make sure we're not not losing money with it. But, you know, we do have the security of our farm business. So, yeah, we're not compelled to be turning out $1 million turnover every year from iPaddock. So it's good. We can. It's really our own R&D program, which we're commercialising, and that's iPaddock.
But doing it yourself isn't always easy. Though there's a whole ecosystem of options out there, people who really want to help startups and programs like accelerators and incubators. For someone like Mick, who's farming full-time, it can be really hard to get access to this support in a way that works for him.
This is so difficult when you're a farmer because you're already isolated. You're not in the networks where you meet people who can do stuff for you and other people you can share knowledge with. And in essence, you know, we're in Western Australia, and there's a very small sort of technology scene in WA because most people go straight to Melbourne if they want to sort of further their careers. So I'm in a remote part of WA, which is a remote part of Australia, and Australia is a remote part of the world. So just having access to people who can do the sort of stuff that I'm trying to do and trying to build skills, and even access to things like SproutX and your farmers to founders, you know, those kinds of things are great. But very difficult for someone in my situation who's full-time running a farming business. You know, I don't have family. I don't have other family on the farm other than my wife, of course. Sort of no one to fall back on, and I can't just disappear for 2 or 3 months. So, yeah, that's been one of the biggest challenges, really, is those sort of the time limitations and the access to support and networks and all of the other things that come with it.
So what has Mick learned and what does it mean for iPaddock?
Like I said, I've sort of been around the circuit a couple of times, and I'm probably at a point now where I guess I understand some of those constraints and I'm working within them. So I haven't downscaled iPaddock or anything like that, but I've probably revised my expectations in terms of, you know, how quickly we can reach our goal with iPaddock and how important it is to, you know, to sell it and flog it and all that stuff. I've sort of backed out of those kinds of things that were taking an awful lot of my time. And while iPaddock as a standalone business, I think the sky's the limit really in terms of what the potential of that business is, to actually realise that would take me away from our farm, which is worth a lot more to us than iPaddock is.
Has anyone ever approached you to, you know, partner and maybe integrate it with some other tech and kind of take on some of that and still reward you for it, but you wouldn't have to do the work? Has that ever come up or been an option or something you considered?
Look, I think that's every entrepreneur's dream, that you come with the ideas and someone else takes all the risk and does all the development. But it doesn't happen. What my experience has been is, if you have a new idea that you know is a good one, which I've had, and they have been good ones, and I know that because the people who buy and use them love them. So, and certainly I know the value that we get from them ourselves. But to start with something like that, which other people haven't thought of, it's a hard sell. You're pretty unlikely to get other people to adopt that and then offer to buy it from you. In my experience, what happens is you have to do all the hard graft, take all the risk, invest all the money and do all the development and the prototyping and all the waste that goes with prototyping when you come up with something that's not better than what you had before and so on. And then once you've got something that's just a hit, then it's of value to people. But unfortunately, what I've found is once it's of value, then people try to take it from you rather than buy it from you. So there's all sorts of challenges. It's sad, but it's true. You know, that's actually, I'm sort of a little bit gun shy now because of some negative experience I've had and that I'm still having there. You sort of become a bit gun shy and less inclined to sort of put yourself out there until you've got all your I's dotted and your T's crossed. But unfortunately, that does limit the uptake of innovation and the development of innovation, because a lot of people go through the same experience where they do all the hard work and then someone else just tries to take all the profit from it. So there's also sorts of hurdles. I don't want to be negative, and I'm not negative. Like, I'm buoyant and optimistic about all of the things that we're doing. But like I say, I've said it a few times, when you get older, you get wiser. And I suppose one of the lessons I've learned has been farming's a damn sight easier than being an entrepreneur. So farming's not easy, as everybody knows. But I tell you, trying to mix it in the cut and thrust of the commercial world, where there's a lot of people out there who don't seem to share your same sort of idea about fairness. Yeah, farming's a much easier place to make a crust, and it's a much fairer place to trade. So there's all sorts of challenges there, but there's opportunities as well. But, you know, this is a learning experience. And like I said earlier, you know, you make mistakes, and it's not bad to make mistakes. You know, what's the saying? It's good to fail fast.
Yeah.
And it is. And we've done a bit of that, and you learn along the way and you get wiser. And in the long game, it pays off. But in the short term, it can hurt a little bit.
Are there any things you learned from the ag tech side that you've taken back to the farming business? Like, any lessons that have gone back the other way?
Probably the lean development approach is an important one. And for the benefit of people who don't know quite what that means, it's basically, lean development means to do things in incremental stages and to be constantly testing what you're doing before you expand it to the next step. So in contrast, the traditional approach to development was, I think they call it the waterfall approach, where you have this idea, so you sit down and you build it as long as it takes with all its features and all its fruit, and then you use it, and if it doesn't work, well, you've just wasted that entire process. Whereas lean development is more about starting with a minimum viable product. There you go, there's another jargon word for you. And so basically just develop the absolute base minimum version of what it is that you're talking about, start testing it and work out what it is that's good and what it is that's bad, and then you build the next feature and then you start testing that, and then you build the next feature and you start testing that. And if something doesn't work, you pivot, you change direction, and you're making little iterative changes all along the way. And one of the benefits of that is you don't get halfway through a really high investment process and then the wheels fall off for some reason, you've got nothing. You've got half of something which is useless. Whereas with the lean development process, you've always got something and then you can keep adding to it. So on the farm, you know, with a lot of the R&D that we do on our farm, and we do have a pretty extensive R&D program. It's not a formal one, but, you know, I've got lots of kegs on the driveways marking out all the different trials that we're doing. And it's the same thing, you know, rather than sort of just decide I'm going to build an air feeder system, you know, feeding system, and just have an idea and then build it, and then who knows whether it's going to work or not. This has been, you know, 5, 6, 7 years in the making, the Alpha Disc, and every year it's sort of been improved on a little bit, and I'm finally at the point now where I've got a machine that we're mass producing, and it's a really good machine. So if I had just started out building what I thought was a good idea at the start, it may never have been any good, and it may well have cost us an awful lot more.
One thing we hear a lot from farmers is all these ag tech startups are trying to flog us a half-built product. And then the ag tech startups are saying, no, it's just an MVP. Like, it's just the early version. Right. And then I guess it's an interesting kind of question, because we often tell entrepreneurs, well, if they're saying that, then it's actually not an MVP. You know, it's not valuable. You haven't hit the minimum yet, but there is definitely a tension in that it's, you know, it's not fully there yet. It's not better than maybe the giant spreadsheet that you've built and used for 20 years. But hopefully adds some kind of value. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that kind of tension in the tech world?
Look, I think it's okay to have a minimum viable product in the market so long as it's priced accordingly, or it might even be free. But what's not okay? I mean, as I've mentioned, I'm primarily a farmer. You know, farming is our bread and butter. The ag tech stuff is very much a sideline. So I'm speaking as a farmer here. And that was what actually motivated me to a large degree to do what I've done with Hypatic, was you'd be paying really high prices for a lot of this stuff that would be peddled out to us by big companies and small companies, and you'd get it and half of it didn't work and it would be buggy and it wouldn't work when you've got no phone range and there's no support. You ring up and then you've got to sign up for a support service to get support for something which should have worked in the first place and it doesn't. You know, that's not really minimum viable product. That's just a rip-off. So I think if you have a base level product that works really well, but it doesn't have too many bells and whistles on it, and it's priced accordingly, I think that's fair enough. And not that that's what we've done with our Paddock, but the apps that I've released, there's a whole lot more that we're doing to the apps and features that we're adding. But the apps, as they stand now, are really good, valuable apps, and they add value to every farm business, and they're cheap enough to buy. So there is a value proposition there, and people appreciate that. But yeah, no, it has been a bit of a scam, and and the reason why is most of these things, most of the technology and even the equipment that we buy, they're coming from a position of someone trying to make a heap of money, which is fair enough. We all want to make money, but that shouldn't be the primary reason for doing something, which it is for a lot of this stuff. So, you know, the machinery is going up 5-8% every year, and it's not really performing any better. In fact, it breaks down more. The software is, you know, several thousand dollars a year to have a subscription to some software package that still crashes and doesn't really do what you want it to do. That's not a good value proposition from my point of view, and I've actually found doing it ourselves, even though it has been an expensive process, at least we've got what we want and what we need, and the value to us hasn't been through selling apps and machinery. It's been through improving our productivity and our profitability on our farm. And a lot of the time that actually has been through just reducing costs. Mm. Like, for instance, with our seeding system that we're using now, we harvest tall because we're using this. So we're saving money at harvest. We can have less headers going faster and losing less grain. So there's a lot of profit there. We don't touch the stubbles until we sow them the next year. We're not out there with slashers and stubble choppers and doing all this other stuff that other people have to do when they're running tines. So while at face value, you can look at distant times and say, oh, look, they do a similar job. When you look at the profit, I mean, it surprises us some years how much profit we make when we really don't think we performed spectacularly well. And it's really because we're still performing well, but we're not having all the costs. So the value to all this innovation that we've been doing is just, it's really reflected on the bottom line for our farm business.
Yep. I think that is something that many of the startups don't understand. And you get it when you don't come from agriculture, haven't spent time on farms. They haven't actually thought about what the real drivers are in the business. And so maybe they're only solving for one part of the system, but they haven't thought about where, you know, where that actual real value can be unlocked or what will really move the needle.
And that's what I find actually with a lot of the solutions these days. Everyone's excited about IoT and, you know, telematics on the headers and all this stuff. It costs a lot of money to have. It adds complexity to your business. And, okay, it's nice to look at your computer and see, you know, where each header's driven around or, you know, see what the fuel consumption was or something. But how is that actually adding to my bottom line? You know, for me, adding to my bottom line means reducing my cost in a tangible way, you know, doing less passes across a paddock or getting the job done more quickly or having better communication or making sure that every paddy gets sprayed with exactly the right amount of product. It's those kind of things that they reflect directly onto the bottom line. And they're few and far between in a lot of the solutions that we can just buy off the shelf because we're paying more and more for all the technology in our equipment now. And it really does all this stuff that it looks nice, but really it's complicating life and it's not actually adding to the bottom line. So I'm not actually the bloke who buys all that stuff. I try to option it out as much as I can because I just want a big capacity machine that's going to be productive and get the job done efficiently. And that's actually getting harder and harder to find, even though we're paying more and more for all this stuff.
Well, and what did you say before? You're going to have to go take it in the shed for a week anyways and rip it apart. So it'll take you a bit longer.
And I'm still doing it. Yeah, even now, like I'm buying all this stuff. And quite often the time in the shed is actually spent just disconnecting all the things that came on the machine because they just drive me mental.
I know my dad is exactly like this. I get a new backpack and he's got to tweak it. He's got to cut off the strap and reattach it. And like, it's this my whole life. So I totally understand. Equipment's the worst. Mick, you mentioned the Lean Startup, the book before. And are there any other resources, books, podcasts, anything that you'd recommend or mention that have been valuable to you in your journey?
I read a book a few years ago called How to Build a billion-dollar app, I think it was. And that was good. I've read a few of these books over the years. Not that I plan to build a billion-dollar app, but there's just lots of good tips in there. In fact, some of that stuff I wish I had read before I started because there were some, like, golden rules in there, which would have been quite useful
broke?
When I was starting out. What not to do. And, you know, one of the big problems I've had, actually, probably my biggest limitation with the app side of it, is that I'm not a coder. I mean, I learned computer programming when I was at uni and I wrote programs and stuff when I was there, but the world's moved on since, you know, the 90s. And I could learn to code, but again, farming's my bread and butter and it would take me too long. It's not really my cup of tea. So I've had to use third parties to do 100% of that side of it. And when it comes to building machinery, I love welding. I'm quite practical. I've got all the gear down at the shed, so I can actually build the prototypes myself and then I can give them to somebody and say, look, I want you to mass produce this. Mm-hmm. And that's just been such an advantage. I wish I could do that with my tech stuff because my designs are good. They work well, but it's a really long and difficult process trying to communicate to someone who specializes in coding exactly what it is that I need. In fact, quite often they try to get involved in the design, but they don't really understand the application. So you end up going backwards and forwards a lot. And it's just a much harder thing when you can't do it yourself. And I think the people who have done spectacularly well, you know, you look at Twitter and all, Facebook and all these things, the people who built them, they are the people who do it. And you've got the skill and you're not having to try to explain your amazing ideas to someone who can actually, you know, type it into a computer. So, you know, that's probably, if there was one word of advice for people wanting to go down this pathway, is if you have to outsource all the technical side of it, you're already on the back foot. Mm. So I wish, you know, in a perfect world, I wished I could have had an offsider who was the technical person working with me on this stuff.
Another big thing that Mick has learned on his journey is actually something that we talk a lot about at AgVentic, that ideas are important, but it's execution that really matters.
It's not. Actually, I heard a quote not that long ago. What was it? The world needs thinkers and the world needs doers, but what the world needs most is thinkers who are doers.
That's great.
Which is actually, you know, and I guess, you know, everyone has ideas. A number of times people have contacted me and said, oh, look, I've got this great idea and I want to make an app or whatever it is, you know. What do you reckon? And I usually say, reply was just one word, which is no, with like 100 O's in it. Like, it ain't an easy process. You've got to be absolutely committed to it to go down that pathway. But it's, it's one thing to have an idea and it's another thing to actually turn it into reality. And probably the key thing is persistence. Like, it's just a long, hard slog, particularly if you want to make a dollar out of it. And I've been lucky. I haven't had to get investors in because we've been able to bankroll it through the farm business. And while it would have been nice to have investors in terms of the mentoring and the experience that comes with that, what I do enjoy is not having other people telling me, look, you might think that's a great practical feature, but we're going to dump it because we need to put something in that makes it sell more, which I don't like. You know, I don't have to deal with that. So,
yeah,
I don't know. It's an interesting experience.
Yeah, I think it's something we're really, I mean, now I wear an investor hat too, right? But the balance between how do you stay, I guess I truly believe, and we wouldn't be doing what we're doing if I didn't, that staying truly user-centric and building what the users want and will truly add value is the only way to build a good business. And you have to believe that you make money out of that down the road. But I totally understand the challenge that you have, which is slightly a different one of just how do you spend your limited time, and you have one activity that's way more profitable than the other. So that makes a whole lot of sense that you have to pick that one.
Yeah, and what it may mean is it just limits, what we do with our paddock. When I first started out, I thought, let's just see what happens. And I just knew that the potential for what we were doing was, was global and massive. But, it's probably how I started the conversation. You can't really be a specialist in two things. If you want to be a specialist, it's probably you're going to have to focus on one. And for me, I've chosen farming. Now, it doesn't mean I can't do the whole ag tech and the startup side of it. We are doing it and it's successful, but I can't really expect to be the next Bill Gates as well as, a profitable, successful farmer. You have to choose. And, farming is what I love. That's what sort of drives it all. So that's what I've chosen. And then the other thing just has to sort of, I have to devote my spare reserves to it rather than that being my core exercise.
I guess it's a pretty good hobby to have, though, of all the things you could be doing that are probably a lot worse for you.
It's good. It's great. Look, I love it. And I've got to meet some amazing people. I've had some great experiences. I won the Growth Awards for Productivity in 2017, I think that was. And I think a lot of that was largely on the improvement to national farmer productivity because of the sorts of innovations that I've developed, which was a real honour. And I got to go on an international study tour as part of that prize. And I met some really good people. And I think now of all the things that we've adopted in our business, just on the back of some of those kinds of things I've been exposed to, I think it's actually central to why our business is performing well these days is all these other experiences and learnings that we've had, which don't necessarily relate directly to farming. So, no education is wasted, and every experience you have can be useful. And it's just an amazing journey, really. I'm loving every second of it.
It's great to hear you so positive. I feel like I read more of your no with 1,000 O comments on Twitter, and I never actually knew how positive you were. So it's good to speak with you.
Maybe my online persona needs to adapt to more reflect my actual attitude.
Oh, I'm just teasing actually, but it is really good to actually chat with you, Mick. And thanks so much for doing this. I really appreciate your time, and hope we get the chance to meet in person. I would really enjoy that.
That'd be nice. Look, if you're ever coming over this way, or if you think of an opportunity for us to catch up, I would like to meet you. And it's just great to know other people in this space. I mean, I'm sort of like, what is it? That bloke on Little Britain, the only guy in the village. I'm the only ag tech startup guy in the town, I think everybody looks at me like I've got two heads sometimes.
Thank you for joining us on another episode of Ag Tech, So What? You can stay up to date with the latest episodes and news at agtechsowhat.com. And as always, if you have any feedback or other guests to recommend, we'd love to hear from you. Just hop on the website and leave us a comment or send us a message. Finally, if you like what you're hearing, and we hope you do, please share the podcast with a friend or leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again for listening. Catch you next time.